Views and opinions expressed during the drive time are those of Dave Glover and his guests and are not those of Northumberland 89.7. Agree, disagree, or have a comment? Call the station and speak with Dave live on the air. Call 905-372-2321. That's 905-372-2321. Now your host, Dave Glover.
Hey, good afternoon. Welcome back to the Drive Time. It's now time for our weekly installment of Consider This Live with my regular co-host in here, Rob Washburn. Rob, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dave. Great to be here.
Busy all day today. I understand you're still grading papers.
Indeed. This seems to be what I do this time of year. We've got about 10 days left and all kinds of assignments coming in, so it's my purpose in life, my raison d'etre.
That's it. So no spoiler alerts. Any kids doing particularly bad? Don't names. Just say, oh, my God, I can't believe this person even show up in my class.
Actually, the kids do a fantastic
there
job.
There you go. Good.
Fantastic job. Absolutely.
See, he loves the kids. He does. He actually loves the kids. Anyway, we're going to be talking about the Saudi arms deal. Well, not the arms deal. They're not calling it an arms deal. The Saudi sale of light armored vehicles, which are apparently not going to be used to suppress the people of Saudi Arabia. I got a hard time with that one. We'll be talking about that. Yesterday I did an interview with Kat Lantang, and we were talking about the Canadian Blood Service and how it looks as though they may want to abrogate their responsibility for collecting blood in this country and actually open up competition with some pharmaceutical companies, which, you know, I think is just asinine. But hey, that's my opinion, and perhaps it's yours too. But before we get to that, here's Harry Nielsen, because these are just some of the things that people are talking about here on Northumberland 89.7, truly local radio. Here's Everybody's Talking.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind. People stopping still. I can't see their faces. Only the shadows of their eyes. I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain. Going well, the weather suits my clothes. Banking off of the northeast winds, sailing on summer breeze. And skipping over the ocean like a stone. Clothes. Banking off of the northeast winds, sailing on summer breeze, and skipping over the ocean like a stone. Everybody's talking at me, can't hear a word they're saying, only the echoes of my mind. I won't let you leave my love behind. No, I won't let you leave.
Harry Nilsson from the Midnight Cowboy soundtrack right here on Truly Local Radio, Northumberland 89.7. Well, you know, I wasn't going to play it. Talking to Rob, Rob says, you know, we should play this. We got 2 minutes here of Stefan Dion in his own words from CBC today talking about his defense of the sale of light armored vehicles to the Saudi regime. And as I say, it is what it is, listeners. Let's listen.
You said the contract was a done deal. You told Rosemary Bart, you've told many people. But as we know, contract between the Canadian Commercial Corporation and the government of Saudi Arabia does not circumvent the export control approval process. We have emails that were released by the Department of Foreign Affairs last year that show that Debbie Gowling, who's with Export Controls, which she's a chief official there, she was asked by the government of the day, are there any red flags in this deal? And she said, there are none, but I can't give you final assurances or final guarantees until we see the export applications. We have these emails. So that means that the export approval process, the thing that you signed last week, is the most important thing in the deal. How can you say that this was a done deal before you'd signed those export permits?
We did not. No, it's a done deal in the sense that the contract has been signed. It has been signed. And we make the commitment to not redraw this signature. This being said, once the contract is signed, and I said that how many times, to you especially, how many times? I will repeat, and please repeat again. Once the contract is signed, the Minister of Foreign Affairs keep the power to allow or to revoke the export permits. So where is your problem? I don't understand.
You just did the export permits. You could have changed your mind.
Yes, but the process about the export permits is to look at if the equipment has been properly used. That's the base on which I make my decision. Once you have accepted the contract, and it's what we did, and we said during the campaign we would do, then the Minister of Foreign Affairs must look at the export permits and receive recommendations about the way it is used by the country. And as you have seen, all the assessment that has...
All right, so there you have it. He sort of got cut off there at the end. But his assertion is that, yes, the contract was signed for the sale in 2014. The export permit permission was not signed off. But as he said, as the Minister of Foreign Affairs and the Ministry, only refuses to sign off on such deals if there is, and he says this, clear evidence that the material is going to be used for purposes that violate the human rights or violate the rights of individuals in the country to which the product is being sent. If they have no concrete evidence that is the case, apparently they've done some looking around to see if that is in fact the case, and they have no evidence, reliable evidence, I think was the phrase he used, to determine that that this deal should not go forward. That was his position. Now, these are light armored vehicles. We know that Saudi Arabia is in the process of fighting, if you will. They're calling it a rebel insurgence in Yemen. I'm calling it a proxy war. We know that that's what's going on. We know that they have been putting their people down in really quite horrendous ways. As long as you follow what's going on over there in the kingdom, you're doing okay. If you step out of line, if you believe that you have free speech, which apparently you don't in that country. I mean, everything that I've read indicates it's essentially a dictatorship. It's not a benevolent dictatorship either by any stretch of the imagination. This is a country that has reported high numbers of executions, the second in the world only to China. And these are public executions, all right? Public beheadings. They have stoned people to death. There was a gentleman who has been receiving 1,500 lashes. He's only received 50 so far. So these are public displays. All of this is happening within the kingdom. This is a country we're selling weapons to, light armored vehicles. So the position of the minister is that, well, as long as we don't have credible proof that these weapons aren't being used against the regime, against the people of the regime, there's no reason for us not to sign off on it. That's the reason.
It's also important to note, too, that these machines are armed with machine guns and anti-tank.
They can be.
Capabilities. So it's all really splitting hairs, Dave. And I'm not sure why they're so anxious to go forward. Even I think Erwin Kotler and Lloyd Axworthy have spoken out publicly, urging him not to go forward with this. Why do you think they're going forward, Dave?
Well, he has said it, and he said it even today during that quest, during that moment there. But we just, obviously they didn't have that as part of their clip. He said, "Look, the government of Canada has signed a contract. It's not, you know, and it's not the responsibility of a new government to come along and supersede an existing contract between this government and another nation or another trading partner." He said it diminishes Canada's credibility. If a new government comes in and decides to just toss out a whole bunch of deals that were signed, the premise from the current government is that if they do that, then Canada's signature on a contract isn't worth the paper it's written on. That's ultimately their justification. And I have even said this myself. I said, you know, look, the bottom line is this is a deal that was signed 2 years ago, was entered into 2 years ago. For whatever reason, it wasn't the export permits weren't finally signed off on, probably because the product wasn't ready to be shipped yet, and they're time sensitive. But, you know, the reality is that this was a deal set up by the previous government. They don't want to take the red pen and strike out their signature because they said they don't want to put a black mark on Canada's ability to negotiate deals like this in the future.
But don't the Saudis also hold a great deal of North American debt? I know they hold a lot for the U.S. I'm not aware of how much they hold for the Canadian.
I have no idea whether or not they've purchased Canadian debt or whether they hold Canadian bonds. I don't know what the deal is. I know that we just basically handed them the Canadian wheat board. Mm-hmm. That was something. I mean, this was, and again, it seems as though the two deals, although they were discussed separately, it seems as though the two deals go hand in hand. You know, well, right, well, we'll buy the LAVs from you guys at this price, but, you know, you got to sweeten the deal. And the Canadian government, as far as I can tell, sweetened the deal by giving them the Canadian wheat board.
Do you have anything concrete?
That's supposition on my part, of course.
But interesting.
But it's you know, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck. I mean, there's a good chance you got a duck in your basket, right? I mean, you know, these two deals came down at the same time. There was some wrangling initially, but I mean, anybody who knows how the wheat board deal went down, they got it for a song. I mean, the fact that the federal government wouldn't allow wheat farmers to set up their own wheat board, to buy the wheat board, and I mean, they wouldn't even let them into the negotiation process on that deal.
So is this a tempest in a teapot? Is this going to go away by Friday or next Monday, and then we're not going to hear anything about it? Or is this going to be something that's going to maybe put a bit of a stink on Trudeau and his government?
Well, I think try as the opposition may. I mean, the Conservatives obviously don't have a leg to stand on with this one.
Yeah.
They were the ones who clearly set this thing in motion. Mm-hmm. For them to stand on the other side of the House and rail against it because of human rights violations is not only hypocritical, but, you know, it's appalling. As far as the NDP is concerned, you know, as the minister said, look, the reality was during the election campaign, all parties agreed to sign off on this deal, all of them. So for the opposition to stand in the House and say shame, shame, shame now, again, disingenuous, and quite frankly, it's an embarrassment. So I think it'll probably go away. I don't think there's any way that this thing has a lot of legs. It's no spider, that's for sure. It may not disappear on Friday, but let's face it, once these vehicles start to move out, as soon as something else jumps in. I mean, today they were questioning Justin Trudeau about some of his finances that weren't properly reported. They were trying to link him to the Panama Papers.
Well, then what does that say? And do you think most Canadians really care about it, Dave? I mean, those reporters were very, very anxious, but I wonder if that reflects the same anxiety levels across the country.
And that's a good question. That's a really good question. I mean, there are people like myself who, you know, social justice advocates and what have you, who think this deal stinks. I thought it stunk from day one.
Yep.
I've been talking about it since 2014 myself. Mm-hmm. So people like me, perhaps. But I think the vast majority of Canadians who are more concerned about their day-to-day and incomes, you know, income security and home security and wondering whether they're going to feed their kids next week. I think they're a little more concerned about those things than they are whether or not we're selling light armored vehicles to the Saudis.
And part of this story has been, of course, the economic benefit to Canada because what is it, General Dynamic is employing people to build these. So
that's right.
Kind of hard to sort of put it into context beyond that.
Well, that's how the previous government sold the deal, right? I mean, the reality is the deal was announced. The Conservatives actually announced it at General Dynamics.
Yep.
Right? Their press conference was at the facility where these vehicles are. We're proud to say that these Canadian jobs are going to be providing these to the Saudi regime. So again, for the Conservatives, it was a win-win, right? Canadian exports were going up. We're seeing business abroad. It's worth millions of dollars annually.
Yep.
Plus, we're securing Canadian jobs. What could be the problem? Well, you know, if we were selling these weapons to Saddam Hussein just prior to him being toppled, then, you know, we would be hearing about this. But it doesn't look as though the Saud family is going to be disappearing anytime soon in Saudi Arabia. And apparently they're really strong allies of ours, although I really can't tell you just exactly what they're doing. I mean, I saw Bernie Sanders recently talking about the Middle East and what's going on over there, and something that President Barack Obama even said was the fact that, you know, how are these people expecting, you know, forces from NATO to come in there, Canadian, American, and European to come in there when they're not willing to put their own boots on the ground? That has been the complaint all along, that these countries to which we are occupying, where we're sending our soldiers, where we're sending our young men and women to die, they're not willing to commit the same numbers of troops. So it really is disheartening, because I would cut off trade to the entire region. I don't think we have any business over there. What are we getting, $10 a barrel oil from these people? I mean, do we need that?
Well, and wasn't it not just recently that one of the Middle Eastern foreign ministers was in the United States just basically looking at everybody and saying, price of gas, we're not going to turn back the production levels. And you know, you can all just live with very, very, very cheap oil, and that's the end of it. So, I mean, there's a lot of tension there, but at the same time, I can't help but believe that this has, at its core, is economic.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, that we need them for their trading and for their investment dollars. And
yeah, but what are they buying? All they're buying from the West is weaponry, for the most part. Okay? That's what they buy. They buy their arms from the West. Most of their food comes from us. Right? I mean, you can't grow anything in a desert, right?
No, but at the same time, they have dollars that they can invest in, as we were talking about before. They buy our bonds and they buy our debt, and they keep our economies afloat.
Absolutely.
You know, I can't help
if they want to invest in Canada, more than welcome. Bring your money over here. You know, one of the other things that Stefan Dion said is that we have some 14,000 Saudi students that are being educated in Canada. Mm-hmm. And that one of the benefits of being in a relationship with a country like Saudi Arabia is that because their youth are being educated here, they can hopefully bring back those liberal values to Saudi Arabia and hopefully can advance their society that way. But that is just a pile of you know.
Don't be so quick on that one. I have to tell you, just being in post-secondary education, I know that there's a huge push right now to bring foreign students even to small colleges like Loyalist.
Mm-hmm.
We have people going over regularly to India, Vietnam, India. Where else have they been? All sorts of places, bringing students. My class at Trent University, I had two students from Nigeria. In the class. Wonderful, wonderful students. But there's a big push to bring foreign students here. So
Well, are we exporting our liberalism, though, to those countries? Are those students taking that progressive approach, if you will, back home with them? Or are they just saying, thanks for the education, and now we're going back to get a good job with my mom and dad or whatever? Right?
That would be an interesting thing to find out, how well that works.
Because I'll be honest with you, I don't think it's going to work in a country like Saudi Arabia. I mean, I don't know if you saw the viral video that's going around of the woman who was being stalked by their religious police. But any country that has a unit of religious police who are patrolling their streets and stopping women for having nail polish and lipstick, I mean... I don't know that we need to be trading with them. I really don't. I don't know what they're... I mean, again, as you say, they invest millions of dollars, but the millions of dollars they're investing is money that's coming from us. We're buying their oil.
Oh, no question. You know? I'm not justifying it, Dave. It doesn't boggle my mind that mm-hmm. we want to be trading with these people. For the sheer fact that they have the money to put into the country.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, look, until Saudi Arabia, it's, you know, what's really funny about what we're going through right now in this oil situation. You know, if you remember back in the mid 70s when we were going through the oil crisis, the problem with oil back then was because we were so reliant on the Middle East, we weren't producing our own oil. And so the price was going.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Well, now, because we're producing so much oil, we don't actually need their oil, and it's $10 a barrel. So now they're able to force the price down, which means that if we want to produce it, we got to do it in a way that's not cost effective, and so they're actually forcing us out of it. So it's like the energy crisis, but in reverse now. You know, here we are 40 years later, and it's been like literally 40 years from the lineups to the point now where we've got, you know. They said they had something like 300 million barrels of oil in reserve. Like pretty much all the reserves are topped up.
Yep.
You know, you're not getting any more reserves, and yet they're still producing. So, you know, this is what's driving the price down. This is what the Saudis are saying. Look, it's not our fault the price is so low. You guys are producing it. You just need it. So, and they don't care. They say if you can't afford to produce it, then they're producing it at $10 a barrel as opposed to WTI, which is $57.
Yep.
Right? So it really is. It is almost like the energy crisis in reverse, but what they've done is crashed our economy by doing the same thing. Now, I'm not blaming it entirely on the Saudis, but, you know, it is OPEC that controls the major pricing for oil. So they do share a certain degree. And realistically, for them, I mean, it's how is it fair for – and again, it's business, so nobody cares about being fair. But how is it fair for them to say to the rest of the world, well, screw you guys. We're just going to keep pumping it out. And if you can't afford to compete with us, then tough toenails. But by the same token, everything that comes into that country has to be bought abroad. Maybe we should start imposing tariffs on Saudi Arabia so that we can eventually get some of that money back.
Well, then what do? They produce more, drop the price down?
Well, they're going to have to cover the costs. I mean, they're already starting to struggle. I mean, the people are already seeing struggles over there with their low price of oil. I mean, they're getting less money as a result, and they don't care. Yeah. So you're listening to The Drive Time here on Truly Local Radio, Northumberland 89.7. My guest in studio, Rob Washburn, my co-host here on Wednesdays for Consider This Live. We're going to take a break, and when we return, we'll have so much more right here on Truly Local Radio, Northumberland 89.7.
Come on out to Hometown Bingo to see what's new. New $3 two times lucky game. Luck Pot will be played on all regular games. Pot of Gold will be played on Hometown Progressive, Mini Progressive, Player Progressive, and Super Jackpot games. New Night Owl games happening after the 7 p.m. session on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evenings. Four regular games and full card jackpot game. Number will increase each day the game is played. We are at 884 Division Street. Call 905-372-5426 or visit hometownbingo.ca. Our license number is 7884.
I'm standing here with Miss Jan Sprague. Jan Sprague from the Jan Sprague Show.
Here on Northumberland 89.7.
Jan, 2 years in the running, how has this experience changed you?
It's been fantastic. Honestly, Jim, it has been such an honor to get to know the people here in Northumberland, not only as listeners, but also the movers and shakers, and making sure that my listeners know what's happening here in Northumberland. Every Thursday afternoon, Thursdays at 12 noon, you can catch me here on Northumberland 89.7, Truly Local Radio.
Established in 2003 in the heart of Toronto's Queen West and Distillery districts, Engine Gallery is now open in beautiful downtown Port Hope at 32 Walton Street. Director Stephen Schwartz invites you to view Engine Gallery's wide variety of quality, original, contemporary, and fine artworks from international and local artists. Drop by Tuesday to Sunday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., or by appointment. Visit enginegallery.ca.
Listen to Northumberland 89.7 live online at tunein.com/Northumberland89.7.
Welcome back to The Drive Time, everybody. Well, for some of you that tuned in yesterday, I was interviewing Kat Lantaine. She is an activist who is working to ensure that we get the idea of paying for blood out of the conversation. Her particular position is that, you know, why should the Canadian Blood Service be competing with pay-as-you-go blood services? And I mean, it affects – we talked about so many effects here because, you know, in countries like the U.S., for instance, mm-hmm. where some states will pay people to donate blood, what they've seen is a reduction in the number of people who actually voluntarily donate blood.
Absolutely.
So when they do a blood drive they do blood drives here all the time. And if you're in Toronto and you'll go by the Manulife Center, there's always a sign out saying, you know, blood donations. But what they're seeing in those states is that because they pay people usually $40 I'm not sure if it's $40 per liter or $40 a visit. That's actual cash. And what they're seeing is it's not just being used by – it's being used as an income supplement for a lot of these people.
Sure.
In Norway, they had a thing where they were doing that. They finally banned it.
Mm-hmm.
And now they can't get people to voluntarily donate because there's a whole generation in Norway that have grown up. When you donate blood, you get paid. Mm-hmm. So how do you convince young people who've grown up in that system that that's not how we're doing it here anymore?
Yep.
So they've seen a great reduction in the number of people who are attending the blood drives.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Canada, you know, it hasn't been that bad, but we are always, you know, struggling to get the blood in. We're always struggling to get the numbers of people to show up for blood drives. If we start paying people for their blood, we're going to have fewer and fewer people volunteering. Plus, once you pay for it, let's face it, what we're doing at that point is we're turning blood into a commodity.
Yeah.
Right? Blood, it becomes commoditized, like, you know, like oil. And we use the reference of oil quite a lot in our conversation because the oil that's being sold, particularly to this pharmaceutical company in Saskatoon, for instance, Canadian Plasma Resources, that blood's going out of the country.
Is that right?
That's not even blood that's going to be used by Canadians.
Mm-hmm.
So what they're doing is they're competing with the Canadian Blood Service, and that the Canadian Blood Service collects blood for Canadians.
Yep.
This other company is paying people for their blood, mm-hmm. and it's going offshore to be used. Now, some of it does come back to Canada as blood plasma medication, but not much of it, if any of it.
Okay.
The majority of it gets sold abroad.
Wow.
So, I mean, where's the motivation here? Where's the logic, in my opinion? I think it's completely bereft of any logic.
But at the same time, I mean, this is the slow encroachment on our healthcare system of a two-tiered system. And, mm-hmm. and this is one more way that we're tearing at the very fabric of healthcare in Canada.
Well, yeah.
And obviously, it sounds, well, not obviously, but it sounds to me like it's very detrimental. And I've heard arguments of why it's so important that we donate blood. I mean, there's so much of it used. I'm sorry, Dave, I don't have any statistics I wish I could share with you because mm-hmm. I know that there's a huge demand and a great deal that it's used.
Well, it's a problem, right? It's a problem because, you know, as I say, it's getting harder and harder to get people to come into the mm-hmm. To the blood clinics or to the blood drives and donate any blood. We do have a caller online. We've got Ed. Ed, welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you doing?
Pretty good, man. What's your opinion on this? Do you think we should be paying people for their blood or...
Are donations down?
You
know, like, do we have to?
No, I don't believe we have to.
You know, like,
I just think it's they're using it as a motivating factor to get more people to donate blood to this particular company.
Right.
You know, and it's not that it's being donated to the Canadian Blood Service, right? It's being donated to
a private company.
They're compensating people with $25. Now, apparently, they're not paying people. They're giving them a Visa card with $25 value on it, and you can use that, but. You know,
I'm not in favor of taking away from the Red Cross and the.
Well, we don't have a Red Cross. Doesn't collect our blood anymore,
no,
right?
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
the blood services,
mm-hmm.
Whatever they're called. I'm not in favor of that, but that's sort of not why I called. I know that's what you're talking about, but.
Well, you want to talk about something else? Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to ask about. Okay, this is coming from a person, me, who literally. Doesn't understand this situation. Okay.
Okay. Which situation?
I understand no part of it. The Northern Ontario, was it Northern Ontario, where all the kids were going to commit suicide?
Attawapiskat. Yeah, Northern Ontario. Yeah.
Okay.
James
Northern
Bay.
Ontario. Okay. Now this is may sound stupid or naive or whatever it is, but I've seen pictures of the place where they live. It's a very small community.
Mm-hmm.
Very isolated community. Evidently, it's a fly-in only.
Well, they have the ice road in the winter.
Yeah, they have the thing in the winter. But when I look at it, I look at, okay, if you look at our kids here,
mm-hmm.
when they get bored, they do stupid things. Okay, they do graffiti, they go out and break into cars, they do dumb things. Now, everybody's talking about sending all kinds of money to this, community.
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to build things for people to do? Like, are they going to build places where these people can work? Are they going to build places where they have, I'm going to say something dumb, but arcades or places where they can...
Somewhere for the community to let off steam.
Community centers. Like I do, okay, I get it. Yes, they should have water. I get it. They should have better housing. But that's not my point. My point is these kids, to me, would seem to be like any kid anywhere in the world. They want stuff. They want, they probably fight with their parents. They probably are bored with school, whether they're doing well or not doing well. The point is firing money in and fixing up their houses and providing water is not going to, as far as I can see, is not going to make the kids any happier. There's still not going to be anything for them to do. I don't understand the situation. Okay, like if they're not hunting, like people say, well, they want to be there because they're hunting and they're a society that's based on that. Obviously, that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there's something the kids want. I mean, you know, again, being totally naive and a complete idiot about this stuff, do they have internet? Are they exposed to stuff that's going on in the world, places they want to see, you know, things they want to do? How are they going to fix that? Are they going to get them jobs? You know.
Well, I think what they're trying to work on right now is basic infrastructure for these folks, just so they've got, you know, I mean, right now they have two medical personnel. My understanding is they only have two people up there that are doing any medical help,
yeah.
And they're doctors.
Yeah.
They're not trained psychologists. They're not trained to deal with this kind of situation, and they're burnt out, quite frankly.
No,
so what the federal government is talking about is not just throwing money at the problem. This is not what they've been talking about. What they've been talking about is getting more healthcare workers up in there to deal with the situation. Because part of the problem is exactly what you're talking about. They don't exactly know what is going on up there. They don't know. And apparently, the rash of suicide attempts that have occurred recently are as the result of a suicide pact among a group of kids. But, I mean, they've got huge issues up there with, because as you say, there's not a lot to do up there, man. There's,
well, no, I get that, but that hasn't changed in 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Wow. Nothing has changed in 50 years.
So there's the problem, Ed. You've just described it. Nothing has changed in 50 mm-hmm. years. And you can imagine going home to the squalor that they live in. They don't have good water. I know, for example, the Anglican Church of Canada has been working with this community to build water filtration because they can't drink the water that runs literally right beside the community.
Well, obviously,
because it's been a problem. There's also the mental health impact. I mean, we're talking about residual impact of the residential crisis, the intergenerational impact of that. There's no mental health services up there whatsoever. I saw a story today in the Globe and Mail. It was really fascinating, Ed. The kids were allowed to sort of put up a list of things that they want, and one of the things they're asking for is just equipment so that they can play sport, because they don't have balls or bats or anything to just to have a fun game.
But forever and a day.
Mm-hmm.
People have been sending books. They've been sending lacrosse equipment. I mean, when our kids were growing up, everybody donated their used hockey equipment.
Is that making it to this remote community? I would argue that it's not.
To this one? No, but I mean, where are they going to? They don't have a community center.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like, I mean, we can get, within 48 hours, we can go to Haiti and we can have running purified water in 48 hours in 100 different places, because they've got all these little things that they set up, and yet they can't get water to these people. This is the part that, first of all, blows my mind, okay, is the fact the technology is there. Obviously, the will isn't, or the cooperation. I don't know. You're talking to a person who simply doesn't know, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But it would seem to me that the biggest thing, if you've got 13, 14 kids that have got a suicide pact going on, are they thinking about the residential schools? Are they thinking about all this other stuff? Or are they looking and saying, geez, you know, I really want a video game, or I want to go and see an Oilers hockey game, or there's absolutely nothing going on here for me to do. We've done everything, so it's over. You know, like, I don't know if, I mean, you know, a lot of poor people in your life, where the fixing up the house would not change the kid's life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
I don't think it's as easy as this. I mean, you know, these kids are dealing with a lot more than that. It's just, you know,
boredom.
Are dealing with boredom. Some of them are dealing with sexual abuse issues that
yes,
they don't have
absolutely.
Anybody to talk about. Here's an interview with a 17-year-old girl who says, "Look, you know, I carry a lot of stuff in me. Many say bullying, overcrowding, boredom, and loneliness." She says,
yep.
"But you know, the reality is that she has family problems. She says there's things that happened to her when she was a kid that she can't talk to anyone about, and that's pretty commonplace up there." You know,
they're
dealing with the fact that they don't have any outlets. You know, the teen also says that she agreed, you know, that she says that bullying and suicide aren't being discussed or they are discussed, but you know they don't really talk about anything else. They're not talking about ways to solve the problems. I think part of the issue for these remote regions is that the government in Ottawa just sends money. Oh, just throw some money at them, but you know, and then they whine and moan about how the money's being spent because it's not being spent the way they wanted it to be spent. You know, you look at this is the same Attawapiskat where Theresa Spence was the chief, right? She's the one who went on the hunger strike a couple of years ago, and the only story we heard about her wasn't about her community, was about her how her and her husband were allegedly stealing money from these people. Now, again, none of that was ever proven. There was all these allegations running around, but nothing ever came that was substantive. And yet the only story we talked about was the fact that the chief was a crook. We never talked about the life of the people up there. The federal government saying, well, we're not going to give them more money because she's a crook. Well, that's your opinion. You've got no proof to base that on. But by the same token, the people who she's trying to get help for don't get the help they need. They don't get the help.
Well, my big question on that is, do these people want to be there? Okay, do they want to be isolated, remote, with a lifestyle that perhaps is not the same as it was, many years ago? Do they still want to be in that situation, or, do they want to, move?
Well, I'm sure the ones that want to move have been given that opportunity. Every time these things come up, the government always gives these people an opportunity to get out of there if that's their choice, if they want to move. But no, I'm pretty sure that the majority of the ones that are still there are there because they want to be there. They want to protect their heritage, their culture, all of that stuff.
That's the question that I asked. Do the kids want to be there?
Don't know. I'm sure if they...
No, but isn't that a question that should be answered?
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, like I know, I'm just throwing this out there for discussion sort of thing. It would seem to me that if they have access to, what's the old song there from the Second World War? How are you going to keep them down on the farm once they've seen Paris?
Yeah.
If they have access to TV, internet, all that other kind of stuff, don't you think they'd want it?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I don't know. Or maybe they are, maybe the kids are really deeply into their culture and everything else, and they do want to be there. But, it just seems that it's 13 kids, that kind of stuff. It seems like, wow, boredom would be really, something to go on there. But, I'm just...
Well, it is boredom for a large majority of them. That's what they're saying. There's nothing to do. They say that young people are being bullied by the older folks there, probably because they're not working. Yeah, get a job, you bummer. The normal stuff.
Well, do they have work. And like, what kind of industry do they have?
Well, Ed, just to go back for a second, I've got something here from the Globe and Mail, and it says that, this attention on what's happening on the reserve, some people say they should move to big cities. And they say studies have shown that urban resettlement is, as a solution, does not solve the problem of suicide. Indigenous people do move into cities, Statistics Canada released a report in January that found that more than one in five off-reserve First Nations, Métis and Inuit adults have reported suicidal thoughts or at some point in their lives. So it doesn't go away just because you move them from the reserve into a city. It's still a prevalent problem, and it's culture, it's poverty, it's so complex. I don't think, it's very hard for us to sit here and even begin to imagine the kind of lives these people lead and what they need. So I don't know how to take it beyond that, but I thought I'd add that, Ed.
Yeah, I again, that's exactly the point. I don't know. I'm sitting down here. I'm looking at the pictures, and I'm thinking, because I'm sitting down here, I'm thinking, why would you stay there? If there's no jobs, no recreation, nothing going on, and from the reports, they can't even hunt and fish, but if they could, how many would want to do that?
But I mean, it's unemployment. It's a lack of access to a good education, substandard infrastructure. Well, and they move to the city and they face the same issues, getting a job and, getting into school and performing well.
And they've also said, and this is something the kids themselves have said, and these are kids in grades 4, 5, and 6, okay? This is what we're talking about, little kids here. We're not talking about teenagers. We're talking about little kids who say that, some as young as 6 have said, look, they nobody cares about them. The only way they can get any help from anybody is if they're in distress, right? So now you have kids as young as 6 years old harming themselves to try and get some attention, So, I mean, what do you do in a situation like that? Well, clearly you need to bring in some counselors, which they don't have right now. That's been part of the biggest problem is that, you know, they don't have counselors. They don't have anyone they can talk to. There's nobody there that will ask the questions. And what they said was that it's like nobody cares about them. This is what they're saying. So, you know, many people are talking about the state of emergency that's going on there. But as far as the kids are concerned, you know, what they need is somebody to tell them that they're worthwhile, that they're you know, valued as people and as they grow up to have that reinforced. But they're not getting that. They're not getting that. And you know, for a lot of them, their parents didn't get that either. You know, I mean, there's a lot to be said about that feeling of self-worth, right?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and even kids in our own community go through this. So, this isn't foreign to us down here in the southern part of the country.
No, it's not foreign to us in the southern part. I get it. I just don't see a solution in that matter if there's no jobs and there's nothing for people to do. Okay,
mm-hmm.
You know, that's the way I'm looking at it. If you know, you can have the happiest kid in the world. But if there is no chance he's getting a job,
mm-hmm.
and he knows it, that's got to be the root of the problem.
Well, and you know, your point about it going on and on and on for years. I mean, you know, there was the flooding emergency in 2013. There was the state of emergency that was declared in 2011, right?
Yeah.
In 2009, 2006. I mean, this has been going on just in the last 10 years. This is just reports over the last 10 years.
We have the technology to fix the water problems. We have the technology to fix the housing
mm-hmm.
problem. We don't have the technology, or it doesn't seem so, to fix the jobs. And, you know, like what kind of company or what kind of thing are you going to have up there? Are they going to open mines?
Well, that's the Ring of Fire supposed to be up there, isn't it?
Yeah, would mines help them out? Like
mining, hydroelectric power facilities up there, because again, they're right off the. I mean, they're just a few hundred kilometers away from Quebec's James Bay hydro facilities, right?
Yeah, there's got to be some kind of thing they can do to get some work up there, so these people, work generally transmits into self-worth. You know, if you're doing a job, you have some feeling of self-worth because you're doing something.
I think their biggest problem has been infrastructure, or the lack of funding for infrastructure and for stable housing. I mean, that was the complaint the federal conservatives had. They were questioning the housing crisis when we give these people millions of dollars every year. What are they spending the money on? You know, this is a part of the country where a bag of sugar costs $40.
Yeah.
So what are they spending the money on? You know, and the other problem, too, is access, because, of course, we can say to them, well, we should be able to build a water facility up there. No problem. Well, you can't get it to them. You know, they only have an ice road in the wintertime. The rest of it, everything else has to be flown in. So obviously doing massive construction projects up there are hugely, hugely expensive.
And
so
you have to train the people how to use the facility,
yep.
how to fix it when it breaks down, how to, you know, it's not just as simple as, well, put it in and flip a switch and it's going to work forever.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was something else they said. I mean, they did have a water treatment facility in there at one point, but they had a problem with the filtration,
yep.
and they couldn't get the crew up there to fix that problem. So they literally just had to shut the plant down
yep.
and do something else, boil yep. water advisories.
Yep.
So, I mean, there is a lot to be said for living in that type of isolated region. But as you say, Ed, you know, if it's so difficult, why don't they just move? But, you know, it's their land.
Yeah, well, I didn't mean it that way.
No, I know. I get what you're saying.
You know, it's just that, wow, it's if there is no hope, then
mm-hmm.
sometimes you got to, you know, got to do something. But I mean, they got to do something more than just throw some money at them. They
mm-hmm.
got to get.
Well, they're sending crisis workers up there. That's the first thing they're going to be doing is sending some crisis workers up there to work with the kids and try and figure out if they can get to the root
yeah.
causes of this and what's causing the problem and why it's lingering. Because you know, this is a community. This community in particular, and there's a similar community as well in northern Manitoba that's not getting any attention, by the way, and they're going through exactly the same thing in northern Manitoba right now. But every year they get beset by spring flooding,
yep.
right? They don't have the ability to deal with that because, of course, that is another infrastructure project that costs think about it. Anything that costs $1,000 down here, you multiply that by $100 easily in northern Ontario.
And, Dave, you know, the water problem is it's so many reserves. Even the one over in Tiandanega has a problem with water, and
mm-hmm.
It's been an ongoing problem for more than a decade. and doesn't seem to be getting any attention or action.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so tragic that it has to come to this before we wake up to the fact that things need to change.
Well, like Rob said earlier, I hope this doesn't go away by Friday, okay? Because this, to me, this thing is way more important than selling Jeeps to Saudi Arabia. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about our own people here that are suffering.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
yeah.
Let's take care of our own people before we... You know.
Well, and you know what? The Premier of Ontario said this, and I would have to echo her as well as Perry Bellegarde, the Chief of the Assembly of First Nations. He said, look, you know, we need a First Nations-directed national strategy to address First Nations suicide rates and ensure that people are safe and thriving. We need a sustained commitment to address longstanding issues that lead to homelessness among First Nations, particularly among the youth. And that is the problem. There really has not been a strategy. You know, Chrétien talked about his white paper and all these other things. We've had lots of patriarchal-style governance, if you will, but we have never had a real nation-to-nation conversation. Because no, I don't think anyone's even asked these people the question you're asking, Ed. I really don't. I don't think that's something that comes up in conversation.
No.
And I think that's a shame. We're going to go to our last break. And
yep.
When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about Canada's blood supply. Because I honestly believe that Canadians are in for a rude awakening if this moves forward. Thanks, Ed. Thanks for your call.
Yep. Bye.
Thanks, Ed.
All right, so as I say, we're going to take our last break of the hour. When we come back, we're going to talk about this, Canada's blood supply and the safety of our blood supply, whether or not that's a reality at this point. And also the TPP aspects of it, because once blood becomes a commodity like oil, well then, you know, it becomes just another something that people can sell. And blood is more important than water.
One thing we know for sure, being in control of your finances in retirement just feels good. At Empire Crossing Retirement Community, we believe renting is the preferred way to know, with certainty, just how much you'll spend monthly on living expenses. We are a rental community with no additional monthly maintenance fees, 24-hour nursing care, home cooking, and so much more to make you feel at home. Experience the freedom of renting in retirement with Empire Crossing and connect with us today at empirecrossing.ca.
Well, that washer quit again.
Well, I don't know what to do with it.
Well, I do. If you need in-home service, new or used parts, previously loved appliances, advice, or stimulating conversation, come on down to Ed White Appliance Service, 51 Mill Street South, or call us at 905-885-7109, where we love to say, yes, it is worth fixing.
Kick back with a frosty pint and cheer on your favorite team at the new pub and restaurant, Turtle John's in Port Hope. Game night won't be the same at Turtle John's, the biggest living room around, with 20 high-definition big-screen TVs. Enjoy delicious pub food or our daily specials for lunch and dinner. Join us at Turtle John's, located at 64 John Street, Port Hope, where it's always game on. Check us out on Facebook or call 905-885-7200. That's 905-885-7200.
Hi, I'm Ben Bird. Join me and Dave Glover on Mondays at 4 during the drive time for the Bird Report Live right here on Northumberland 89.7.
And welcome back to the drive time. And of course, Ben will be here on Monday as always. Now, we're talking about Canadians' blood services, folks. You know, there was after 1997, okay, when we had literally, well, an entire generation of hemophiliacs was wiped out by this, literally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we actually have, you know, children's graves that we can stand over because of the debacle in 1997, okay, because of the tainted blood scandal. You know, and at one point a few years ago, there was a report that they were buying blood from convicts in the United States, and mm-hmm. we were getting some of our blood supply from there. That doesn't happen anymore. The Canadian Blood Service takes care of our blood supply because, you know, we need a Canadian model to protect Canadian blood services. That's why it was created. But they want to take the brakes off it. They want to deregulate it. They want to privatize plasma collection. And let's face it, folks, it is ridiculous. The fact that they have said, look, the viral inactivation process existed for 10 years when Justice Creever made his recommendations in 97, and Canada had access to safe blood products throughout that period. The argument being put forth is that, well, no one's been killed in the last 20 years by deadly viruses, so I guess we can deregulate. And as I said yesterday, you know, we know what happened when you deregulated the banks. All mm-hmm. of a sudden, there was a problem. How right. quick will it be, you think, Rob, before there's a problem?
Pretty quick, Dave. It'll happen almost simultaneously.
Hey, you've got some numbers on donors and donation activities.
I've been doing
activities.
A little bit of homework here, and as we've been talking, Canadian Blood Service says that they need up to 100,000 new donors every year to keep on top of the demand for blood. That it takes 50 units of blood to help a car crash victim, and that that's a lot of new donors, don't you think?
Absolutely.
Incredible, incredible number. And I'm still trying to find, if anybody can find it out there faster, how much blood is donated every year in Canada. I can't seem to find it just yet. But I can only imagine how much we need and how desperately it is needed.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, there is a petition going around. It's being signed by medical professionals across the province. I was talking to one of my Twitter followers yesterday. She was at having blood work done in Toronto, and she had 12 nurses sign the petition because they're saying, you know, we've got to protect our blood supply. I mean, let's remember, folks, you know, when we weren't keeping our eyes on our fries, you know, how many people died that were infected with AIDS? How many people got hepatitis C? And how many people got other blood-related ailments? And there are other viruses out there that are resistant to whatever is done to blood in order to purify it, right? Like, for instance, there's a number of the Zika virus, for instance. We know everyone's talking about the Zika virus. You know, when you buy blood from just some Joe Schmo who walked in off the street, you know, what kind of background is being done on that guy? Well, if you're buying it for pay at a private plasma clinic, you know, I'm gonna throw it out there. I don't think they're nearly as stringent as they should be. I think what you're going to see is a lot more possibility, anyway, a greater possibility of there being problems with the blood. And I for one know that when I go to the doctor if I need any emergency blood work or any more emergency blood, I don't want to be possibly receiving, you know, tainted blood. Especially, I don't want to get the Zika virus because I had to get a transfusion. Do you?
Mm-hmm. Not me.
So, I mean, we need to ensure those protections, and we need to ensure that those protections remain. You know, I don't know how much clearer we can be. I mean, there as I say, there is a petition that is going around. There is a blog out there. It's put out by OPSU. It is an OPSU blog, but it is what it is. DIA blog U, Diablog is what it is. But you can check that out online as well. But seriously, bloodwatch.org is who you should be checking out as well, bloodwatch.org. As I say, we had Kat Lantaine on yesterday. She was our guest talking about this very contentious subject. The government's not talking about this. Nobody else is talking about this but you and me and that organization. So go ahead, Rob.
I'm happy to say I just found this. Canadian Blood Service says they collect about 195,000 liters of plasma each year.
And of that, they need 100,000 new donors every year.
That's right.
So that is a lot of blood plasma collected. And it's collected in a safe way, in a way where Canadians know that when they need it at the hospital, it's going to be there. And it's not going to be tainted blood. So protect the standards, protect and stand by the Creever report. Tell your member of parliament, tell your member of provincial parliament that you don't want blood for sale in the province of Ontario. I'm Dave Glover. You've been listening to The Drive Time here on Northumberland 89.7. This is Canada's only holistic political chat. I want to thank Rob Washburn for being here. And as always, listeners, thanks for tuning in. Here are Cedar Hill.